From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter. Made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you. And from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album. Available on iTunes.
I'm Sharon Gamble. Welcome to The Art of the Matter. On this week's program, we learn about an indie theater company that pioneered theater for seniors, get a sneak preview of Comic-Con, and find out how Butler Arts Fest helps students connect with world-renowned performers. And don't forget, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do?
All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. On today's show, we'll get our geek on with a sneak peek at Comic-Con and learn why Epilogue Players expanded its mission. But first, Hoosier painter Taylor Smith talks about her indie story, time spent in Germany, and her upcoming artist trips to Europe with contributor Pete Brown.
And today we're here in your studio in the Stutz building, and it's admittedly not my first time here, but it's one of my favorite studios to come to in the Stutz because it's very homey and very comfortable, and your work is all over the place, and it's so diverse. That's one thing I really like about your work. There's so many different mediums all working together. When you first got into art, did you have your heart set on a specific medium, or have you always been interested in playing with lots of different materials?
When I first started painting, which was back in the 80s when I went to art school, I was actually much more abstract, just completely abstract. I liked playing with textures and colors, but as that developed over time, I became more interested in adding in figuration or more abstract concepts like science or mathematics or even pop art, which I've always been very fond of. I just get bored with painting the same thing over and over again, or just a slight variation of the same thing. So that's why I tend to work in kind of like silos, like different series, but I try and connect them.
So are you originally from Indiana? Have you been here forever? What's the story there?
I was born here. I was born here, and I did go to Indiana University down in Bloomington. But then immediately after I graduated, I moved to Europe. I moved to Europe with the intention of studying art, and I speak German, and I spoke German at the time because I minored in German at IU, and I thought, this would just be great. I can live over here, and I can paint in Europe, and I did for almost 6 years, and it was fantastic, and I loved it. But there came a time where I missed my family. I was getting out of my late 20s, into my early 30s, and I thought it's time to move back to the States, so I moved to I moved around. I've been in Chicago, St. Louis, Miami, spent quite a bit of time there, and then came back to Indiana in the mid-90s. When I had a daughter, I decided that this was a great place to stay because my family's here. So I kind of planted myself here and opened a studio, and that's kind of the progression of my history with Indiana.
You have this really unique concept about organizing trips to Europe with other people that are interested in art, other people that are interested in exploring the world beyond of, you know, their back door. What is the concept and the mission with those art trips, for lack of a better definition?
Well, over the years, I know a number of artists who either participate in artist travel workshops where they travel almost like a short sabbatical or just an intensive workshop so that they can improve their style or their skills. And the vast majority of those seem to be very traditional workshops where you are either, let's say you're in Tuscany or you're in France and you're plein air painting, or you're doing very traditional figurative work. But that's not the style of work I do at all. So I have run these workshops on and off over the years, but I would like to do more of them. So this year I'm really focusing on setting up some workshops for small groups. And I thought that it would be very interesting for an abstract artist to travel to Germany or Spain or Morocco and interpret their experience, whether it's taking the landscape or the traditional art of that culture and interpreting it into a vastly different form, whether it's taking the micro or the macro of what they're experiencing and putting it in an abstract form. So basically that's what the workshop is intended to teach, and it's also intended to make new friends in Europe, drink some wine, travel around, and also learn a little bit about abstract art.
Well, as somebody who's traveled and lived in Europe, I mean, what value do you find as a Hoosier that's gone and left and experienced the world a little bit and explored the world a lot, really, and then come back to Indiana? How is that valuable to you as an artist and as a person to leave and come back with a new set of experiences?
I personally think it's the best thing I ever did. I mean, there are two things in my life I consider my top two achievements. One is my daughter, and number two is the fact that I just, when I was 22 years old, I just left. I said, I have no plan. I just packed a cardboard box full of clothes, and I checked it as luggage on an airline, and I guess you could do that back then, but it was just a big cardboard, literally a cardboard box with duct tape around it, and I just moved away. And I think not enough people experience travel and other cultures to understand the world at large. You know, I would much rather than buying a new car or buying a new toy, take that money and travel, because it's such a deeply rich experience that it's one of the best ideas I ever had for myself. You know, it's one of the best experiences. So coming back here and bringing that back, I think it's just changed my worldview, but in a great way.
I know I've seen your work in lots of different physical places, a lot of different places online, different publications. As you think back, was there a defining moment in your art career where you thought, man, I can make this happen?
Just like with music, you know, everybody's like, oh, they're an overnight success. But really, you know, they're a 20-year overnight success.
Right.
Now, it just takes a lot of belief in yourself and perseverance. For many years, I painted at home, or I painted in my garage. And I think one of the bolder things I did is I signed a lease here at the Stutz. And I love this building. There's a lot of great buildings, artist buildings in town, and I would be very happy in many of them. But this is the space I've been in for 10 years, and I really love it. And because I've been here, it's really exposed my work to a lot more people physically than people would normally find me online or in, you know, the gallery. But back to your question, I think one of the best things I did was just getting out of my solo practice, because I was very content to just paint for myself. But once I started opening that up to others, it kind of snowballed from there. And then I've had a few commercially very fortuitous things happen with different design firms or galleries around the country that have picked up my work, and that's helped me financially just keep the practice going, which is great. But ultimately, I like just having a studio where you're publicly known and people can come see your work. I think that's really important.
What's your advice to somebody who's trying to learn more about this art scene in Indianapolis? Where should they go? What should they do?
Just keep going out and experience as many studios and shows and openings that you can, and just get out there and meet people, and things will happen. You know, I can't really say exactly what happened for me, and it's still an evolving process.
Sure.
I mean, there's so many people in town that I don't know, and there's so many studios that I haven't been to, and so many artists' work that's wonderful that I haven't experienced yet. But if you just keep doing that, things just kind of organically happen, I think.
If you had to have a fallback career outside of working in art, how would you go about picking that, and what do you think it would be?
Well, I'm too old for it now, but I love snow skiing. I actually used to, like, compete. I would love to be a ski instructor or live on a mountain and somehow live and ski every day. That would be a dream for
awesome.
Me. Yeah.
Contributor Pete Brown with painter Taylor Smith. Learn more about her story, her work, and upcoming events at abstractmodern.com, and meet her at the Stutz Artists Association Spring Open House. When it was founded in 1976, Indianapolis's Epilogue Players was the first theater troupe for seniors in the United States, and it served as a model for the birth of the so-called senior theater movement in the 1980s. In 1981, comedian George Burns attended the theater's annual banquet and gave the theater five cigars and credited his so-called junior colleagues for their talent. In 1990, Indiana Governor Frank O'Bannon named visiting the theater among his favorite leisure activities. Epilogue recently broadened its mission, though, and I spoke with Duane Mercier about this change and about their upcoming production of the first Monday in October. I'm intrigued. I've known for a long time about Epilogue Players' former mission, which was to put on productions that showcase mature actors. Tell me about the expansion of that mission that you and fellow board members decided on kind of recently.
Mm-hmm. The mission actually hasn't changed that much. We've opened up the membership to anyone under the age or over the age of 18. It used to be you had to be 50 years or older to be a member. So that has changed quite a bit. We wanted to open it up to new talent, bring more people in, more excitement, more vitality into the organization. But our mission of putting emphasis on senior actors hasn't changed. In the past, you know, we don't just put on shows with older characters.
Sure.
We have characters of all ages, but the emphasis has been to provide an opportunity for actors, older actors, to have a venue to get some really good roles and to have a good theater experience in Indianapolis.
And you have bragging rights because at your founding, which was, help me, 1976, this was the first theater company in the United States founded with that mission.
That's what I understand, and it began in theory a movement, or it was at the beginning of a movement of senior theater in the United States, where in 1976 there were I think there were 79 companies of that called themselves senior theater, and then in this year or last year in 2016 it's up to 800.
Wow.
Companies that call themselves senior theater.
Wow, that's remarkable. And you know one of the things that intrigues me is I had to look up some stuff because my first thought was, okay, baby boomers hopped on that because it's an enormous generation moving through the world. However, baby boomers were decades away from being seniors when Epilogue was founded, so it was even in advance of that.
Yeah, it was founded by Bertha Starkus, and she was a retired teacher, and she had directed some theater productions in school, and then when she retired, she wanted an avenue that she could, you know, get involved in, and just couldn't find the right thing. So she said, "Well, I'm going to form my own group," and they called it the Epilogue Players, and it was membership was limited to 50 years or better.
Mm-hmm.
And one of their first productions, they started off playing at the Children's Museum, the Ruth Lilly Theater at the Children's Museum, and one of their first ones was Waiting in the Wings by Noel Coward, which featured a group of elderly actresses that live in a retirement home. So
perfect.
Yeah, it was a perfect venue. And she seemed to be just such a wonderful character. I saw a newspaper article from 1978 where she was talking about forming the group, and she had so much energy and so much spunk and brought such a great life to the group, and really it was all of the rehearsals were in her house, and she pretty much bankrolled the whole thing until Aww. It got started.
What a fabulous role model, too.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And a reminder to people of every age, every production I've seen Epilogue Players do has actors of multiple, you know, different ages. There's always a younger character or two or five. But it's a reminder that, you know, it's never too late to take up a new hobby. It's never too late to say, I used to act back in school, and now I have more time and I want to get back to it. You've had lots of interesting homes. I like your current space, which is very intimate, and you've been doing some upgrades to your current space. Why don't you describe that for me?
Yeah, we have. We have been doing some fundraising efforts, and we've improved the auditorium. We've kind of brightened it up, some new paint. Amazing what a good coat of paint will do. And we're remodeling the backstage area, or the green room, the dressing rooms and stuff like that right now. So we're putting some effort and some labor into kind of sprucing it up, make it a better experience for the cast and crew as well as the audience.
And you have a production coming up in May, the first Monday in October, which seems very timely. It's about Supreme Court justices, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the play was written by Jerome Lawrence and Robert E. Lee before the first woman was actually nominated to the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as I understand it, while it was on its run in Broadway, Sandra Day O'Connor was then nominated. But it was it is an interesting show, and it fits the model of Epilogue's mission very well. It requires 10 men ages 40 to 70. So that should be a good show. It's about the relationship between an associate justice and this woman who's been selected for that.
Epilogue players Dwayne Mercier. Their production of Jerome Lawrence and Robert E. Lee's The First Monday in October opens on May 5th, and you can learn more about that production and the company at epilogueplayers.com. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Later this hour, role-playing games, comic books, video games, and sci-fi. But first, Eat Drink Indie's Jolene Ketzenberger talks craft beer with Jason Werfel of Books and Brews.
So tell me a little bit about your background in brewing and how the beers came about and of course, how you name them.
So the last question first. So everything here is literary in nature. So I mean, part of what we do to try to build the community is make sure both our employees and our customers feel like they're a part of it. And with that, we use them to help us name the beers. But yeah, literary puns mainly, characters, themes.
Give me some examples.
Yeah, so specific books. So our flagship-y beers are, I say flagship-y because we don't really have anything that's, we will in the future, pretty soon here, hopefully have standard house beers that'll be on all the time. But so, for example, Nancy Brew and the Hoppy Boys. Clifford the Big Red Ale, Charlie and the Chocolate Stout, Cream and Punishment, and Shogun Soba Ale is kind of a stretch. But yeah, so we go on and on from there. Blonde with the Wind.
Those are great. Yeah. So your customers like that. They get the puns and they enjoy it, right?
Yeah, well, it's part of the nostalgia factor. So for example, I mean, even you know, we had someone just the other day come in and say, I don't even drink blondes, but I have to have Blonde with the Wind because I love that book. It's my favorite book. And that is, I mean, it's great. It's great from in a vacuum marketing strategy. It makes me feel good as like a, you know, sales marketing guy to be like, yes, the marketing's working. But it's also cool from a nostalgic perspective. It goes back to the whole idea of connecting experience with the product and the desire to connect to people on a level more than just like, I am drinking a beer. And I think that when you can do that, and that's why I think the longevity of the model, it revolves around that nostalgia factor that people feel. For example, when we do a Game of Thrones themed or Song of Ice and Fire. So Sours of Ice and Fire, we did a series of four bottles and people come in and buy them. They don't taste them. They just buy them. I got to have them. I love the books. I love the show. I got to have the beer too. So yeah, that's that I think that is that's how the names come about. Now, in terms of my own background, I am, and this will probably make a lot of people quiver. Like I'm a business guy. Like what I love is business. I love people, and the main focus of my business was just like I said, it was all about the experience and the people. Now, the beer was a part of that, a part of the I lump the brewing industry, especially nowadays, into the creative community with artists and writers and musicians. I think it's along that same line. Gamers, there's a lot of artistry. I think, and that's my angle. I see beer as more of an art than a science, and there's a lot of people that would disagree with me on that. You know what I mean? But that's fine. To each their own. Beer, especially nowadays, is really driven science heavy. For me, it is an art, and it's fun and creative. And so I'm really just some hack home brewer who started home brewing and had a lot of fun with the beer and thought the beer tasted good. And I'm a business guy. And so when I open Books and Brews, I think that that's a strength of mine, that I'm not so traditional. And as a baseball guy, I know this, that, you know, baseball, for example, is a industry steeply rooted in tradition, to where the point where it really affects their ability to evolve because of that. And
because we want it to be the way it is, right?
And I think that that's probably a strength of mine, that I'm not deeply rooted in the tradition of the brewing industry. Like, I appreciate it, right? But it's not like I'm going to, you know,
You're not going to say it's always been done this way, so this is how we have to do it.
Right. Yeah. Like I said, more of an art than a science. So I have fun with it, and it gives me, I think it gives me the leeway to where I'm not so much like I'm this champion brewer that, and this is, that makes it sound like I was knocking that, you know, but like, I'm not going to take advice, or someone says, hey, I want an orange wheat, and I'm going to chase them out because you shouldn't like orange wheats. You should like imperial stouts. You know, like, I'm going to brew it. People want, and I'm going to brew crazy stuff that are going to push the boundaries and do it in kind of a fun, creative, unapologetic way. And
you can hear Jolene Ketzenberger's Eat, Drink, Indie Saturday mornings at 11 on WFYI HD2 The Point. Comic books, cosplay, artwork, graphic novels, live-action role-playing, lightsaber lessons, nerdy speed dating? Last year, Indiana Comic-Con attracted more than 40,000 people to the Indiana Convention Center, and you can laugh at the costumes and quirks, but this 2.5-day gathering had an economic impact of more than $4 million a year ago, and it's poised to get even bigger. Contributor Eric Hartwig channeled his inner geek to learn more.
These are convention centers. PopCon, GenCon, ComicCon, HoosierCon, all of these cons. What is the deal? Well, deep down, it's all about what art can do for the soul.
My spider senses are starting to tingle.
Role-playing games, comic books, movies, and video games all require the help of a creative team of people. But you might be surprised to find out that not all con artists are geeks. Because of these conventions, I've met everyone from Aquaman or Drago for the Thrones fans to our dear Princess Leia. I've walked around with Colossus, got my picture taken with Arya Stark. I've even seen Captain Adama from a reasonably close distance. But how can you tell how much nerd chi a person has? I decided to come up with a geek evaluation test. I'm at Jess West Costumes, and Jess is getting geared up for the next convention, Indiana Comic Con.
A lot of the people see you at these conventions. They obviously assume that you know everything about these people.
Jess is not trying to win trivia night.
Can I get a Quicksilver costume? Have you done any of those?
You're my first.
First Quicksilver. But you know who I'm talking about, right?
I am terrible at fibbing to people. Over the phone, I may be like, oh, yeah, sure. And I'm Googling simultaneously as they're, like, asking me these questions. It's for Medusa.
Various costumes and clothing are on racks and in piles that surround the room. Tubs of glitter, buttons, googly eyes, and even LED lights.
900 feet of hair extensions.
Except for the sewing area, it's pretty tidy.
I make things. That's what
that's
I do.
That's all you do. You're a maker.
I think all artists, they'll find some bits of them that they'll take and put it into their own art.
Jess has definitely put herself into her art.
And I just wanted to give it a test run, so I just rolled down South Meridian when the bars were open at 11 o'clock at night in a Spawn costume. Half the people were like, what is that?
Did anybody know who it was right
away? Oh, absolutely. I had some dudes come up and we were just like bowing down like, oh my gosh. When you can sort of create things that get them really pumped about stuff that sort of is their own escape to their own reality, it's really fun.
So, like, I've come up with this geekometer quiz.
I've been nervous about this one the whole time.
Who is Kal-El?
No clue.
What is the name of the gremlin who has the mohawk?
Spike!
It is Spike.
The costume designer, barely a level one geek. Let's hop on over to Geek Mecca, Greenwood's comic book university. Sometimes I stop by to discuss Infinity Stones, but today I'm catching up with a true blue comic artist, Jackie Crofts.
I'm an illustrator on a book called Nutmeg. It's like Betty and Veronica meets Breaking Bad. I mean, I've been drawing since I was little. I would just sit underneath the table at my grandparents' house by myself and draw while everybody else played cards.
In the gaming room, we ran into the guys from the Kind of Epic show, David West and Gabe Canada.
This has always been part of who I am. It's just become a passion. It's become part of my life. And I surround myself of similar people.
Literally judging a book by its cover, because it's not frowned upon in this medium.
The conversation quickly reaches max nerd level.
Geekometer time. Sonic the
Hedgehog.
What is Daredevil's day job?
Lawyer.
All right, David. Who is Oliver Queen?
The Green Arrow.
The Death Star commander is named?
Tarkin.
Okay, we're obviously dealing with pros here.
Okay, so level four, here we go. One word of Klingon. What is one of the names humans call Cylons in Battlestar Galactica?
Ooh, I actually want to let her answer this.
Okay.
Toasters.
Yes. Toasters!
And now we're off to the cosplay scene. I decided to bring my kids with me to Hoosier Con. My youngest, little lady Emmy, proudly dressed as Batman.
Hello. Oh,
I love little Batman.
We caught up with player-performer Lola Hart. Today she is Belle from Beauty and the Beast and hosting a costume contest.
We're getting ready to start.
The room is filled with strange characters, including an entire Pokemon family. The Gradles. This family is decked out.
Prepare for trouble.
Every member of the family is a Pokemon character.
Team Rocket blocks up at the speed of light.
Mama Gradle put a lot of time into this.
I would say this theme right here took me a month to do.
The entire family is cosplaying.
According to Lola, it isn't uncommon to see this type of confidence at a con.
It's a really good way for people to not only get out and meet new people, but to get outside of their shell as well.
Level one geekometer. What is Spider-Man's secret identity?
It depends on the comic book, but primarily Peter Parker.
And what material is Captain America's shield made of?
Vibranium.
It's clear that you're level four.
Even Melissa Davis, our very own NPR voice here, is fairly geeky. Like The Flash, I'm going into the past. Hacking time to the day Melissa was editing this Art of the Matter segment. I've placed geeky artifacts in the studio. I've also placed a GoPro in the corner, so I can keep an eye on what she's up to. Okay, guys. Thor's hammer, a well-known USS Starship, and a Green Lantern Pez dispenser are in clear view. Melissa's coming into the studio. Oh, she's interested in the items. Level one. She has picked up the Starship and is playing with it. Level two. I better get in there. Melissa, I noticed that you noticed a lot of these geek items in here.
I did.
It's actually part of the geekometer test.
Oh my goodness.
So you've picked up what?
Well, okay, now this is going to show you that I may not... Is this the Starship Enterprise?
That is the Starship Enterprise.
Yes.
Who is the captain of the Starship Voyager?
Oh boy. Captain Kirk?
Well, I guess that's it for this convincing story. It's pretty obvious to me that geeking out is just another artistic expression open to anyone. Be sure to find our team at Comic-Con, where I will bring the geekometer for some impromptu testing. Your results and geek level will be posted to my Facebook page, or WFYI's if they let me. Now get out there and let your freak flag fly.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its five-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
WFYI's Eric Hartwig. Comic-Con is April 14th through the 16th at the Indianapolis Convention Center, and you can learn more and find tickets at IndianaComicCon.com. IndianaComicCon.com. Well, Jill, Comic-Con is coming up. I don't know what to wear. Can I just say that?
It sounds like you can wear just about anything.
Indeed.
And the more comical, the better.
There you go.
Bad hair day, everything goes.
I love it. Well, if Comic-Con doesn't float your boat, we have some other events to suggest to you on that calendar we call
What'll We Do?
What do you have?
Well, coming up on April the 15th, Spark Joy Music and Sugar Booking Entertainment, they're presenting It's Hungry for Laughs, Starving for Words. It's a poem comedy benefit for the Julian Center, and they're going to be having it at the Fountain Square Brewery up there in Fountain Square, and they're bringing in some of these national poets from across the country that are going to come and present their work, and there's some local poets as well taking part in this benefit. It's something new and different. That's where you might want to go on April the 15th.
You know, Mark Twain has a voice that's as fresh and pertinent today as it was when he was writing. And Nettle Creek Players is presenting a play on April 21st, that's a Friday, at the Opera House stage in the historic Hagerstown Museum. It's called The Gospel According to Mark. It's a solo performance piece that captures Mark Twain during two different periods a decade apart. In the first act, he's as he was early in his career performing during his so-called debt tour in 1895, reminiscing about his time on the Mississippi, featuring a so-called reading from The Adventures of Huck Finn. Act two finds him a decade later in 1905 in his study as he reflects on his youth and talks about some pretty serious political issues as well. Once again, that's coming up on Friday, April 21st. If you Google The Gospel According to Mark, Nettle Creek Players, you'll get more information about that.
On April the 19th, IMOCA, that's the Indianapolis Museum of Contemporary Art, they're going to be hosting an artist talk by Sarah Hobbs. Her work is currently on display in their Cityway Gallery, that's right downtown by the Alexander Hotel. Her work is called Psychological Traces, and it's definitely a mind-body-spirit kind of exhibit. On April the 19th at 7 o'clock. Need something else? You can go to the local arts events at indiearts.org/guide. That's the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide. Or join us again next week when we find out
what do we do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and central Indiana. Your host is Sharon Gamble. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202, or you can email us at aotm@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. In just a bit, five songs with Kyle Long. But first, painter Lois Mayne Templeton is working with curator Jennifer Complo McNutt to put together a retrospective honoring her 90th birthday a year from now. Meanwhile, Lois has a show at Clues Memorial Hall with studio mate Phil O'Malley. I invited Lois and Jennifer to tell me what goes into preparing a milestone retrospective and why Lois splits her time between Indiana and Maine. Lois, I want to start with what brought you to painting well into your life. You didn't start when you were 10 or 20.
Well, yes, I did start. Well, I did start, and I was coloring, and I was all alone all of a sudden, and the principal came in, and I was just a kindergartner, so I hid. And she said, "What's wrong, little girl?" And I said, "I'm lost." And so she opened the door to the kindergarten room, and there were all the good little boys and girls sitting around. And I learned that paints were dangerous. They could trap you. They could steal you away. I guess maybe I didn't really paint for a while.
Power.
But something, paints have power.
Something made you brave, because you circled back to it.
Paints up power. And you just said, and here we are with my ears not quite working.
Something made you brave. You got back to painting.
Well, I did. But the only reason I got back to painting was that I had a lust for the materials. And I would go by an artist supply store, and I would look longingly in the window. But I wasn't an artist, you see, so I didn't go in. There are all sorts of reasons people don't do what they really ought to do, for heaven's sake. So I did go in and one day, and I found burnt sienna. Mm. Oh, my. And alizarin crimson. And then I got farther down there, and all these little twiddly palette knives, they were fascinating, but it didn't really hit me that this was special till I got all the way back to the erasers. And I looked at the erasers, and there was a chamois cloth, and I thought, mistakes aren't something bad. You don't really erase them away. You kind of rub them in. And that was what did it.
That's what life is, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
You can't, there's no do-over. There's no time machine. You make a mistake and you incorporate it into your life.
Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
What is the function of a curator? Why do you need this lady sitting next to you? What's the function of a curator and why Jennifer in particular?
Why Jennifer in particular? Well, we have been buddies. We've hit it off for a very long time.
How'd you meet?
How did we meet? Somehow through the Ferris Building, I think.
Golly, I can't remember. It was so long ago, I forget.
It was so long ago. I think you were in the Ferris Building when we first met.
I know I was at the Ferris Building. I was there for a long time. That was a wonderful building. Yeah.
And for our younger listeners who don't remember the Ferris Building, what was it?
Downstairs. Now, Eli Lilly, and I'm sorry. I wish them no ill luck, but they took the Ferris Building away from all of us.
They did.
Were we ticked off.
Yeah.
Why does an artist need a curator?
Because a curator tells you the truth, appreciates what other people might not, has a long experience with a lot of artists. So if you have something special, the curator will say, well, for heaven's sake, look at this, and haul out things that might not have been something you thought was all that good, and the curator will say, no, look at this. Look at what you're doing. Is that what you do?
It's true. It is true.
Well, that's a lucky thing. I just said it. So.
Very nice job.
Do you always look to the curator when a work is done, or do you ever, now that you have a relationship with a curator that you really trust, do you ever ask her to look at a work in progress?
No.
She waits for it to be complete.
Yeah, no, because I paint in Maine now, you know, and I roll it all up and send to Indianapolis, and it's a done thing by the time Jennifer has to deal with it.
But, you know, truthfully, I make it a practice not to comment on an artist's work in progress too much, you know, because you don't want to influence that, you know, you really want it to... You just don't want to influence the artist.
Well, you shouldn't.
Right.
No.
You relocated to Maine about 6 years ago?
Yeah, a little more, eight.
What was in Maine that you couldn't get from Indiana?
Lobster.
Painter Lois Maine Templeton and curator Jennifer Complo-McNutt. See Lois's work in her show with studio mate Phil O'Malley at Clues Memorial Hall through April 24th. And look for Lois's 90th birthday retrospective at the Indiana State Museum next March. Butler University is in its fifth year of Arts Fest, a showcase of multiple arts disciplines that pairs student artists with world-renowned professionals. I invited Butler's Director of Arts and Culture Marketing, Meg Leffick, to tell us more. So, Butler Arts Fest, this is how many years?
This is the fifth year, actually, yeah.
That was fast.
It was. It was. And it's been fun every year, but I think this year might be the best yet.
Now, I know you weren't there for the very first one. You've been at Butler about 3 years. Mm-hmm. But I know you know what was the idea behind the creation of Butler Arts Fest?
Well, it was created as a opportunity for students to have interactions with world-renowned artists, and that was the core of it. And then for the community to have interactions with both those world-renowned artists and the students of the Jordan College of the Arts at Butler University. And so there are a number of opportunities where students are performing on stage with Grammy Award-winning artists, with artists who have performed on stages throughout the world. And here they are at Butler University and performing with our 19, 20-year-old future artists on stage.
There must be a lot of starry-eyed moments behind the scenes about that.
There are. And one of the fabulous opportunities is actually these students get master classes with a lot of the visiting artists. And so they hopefully are a little past those starry eyes by by the time they hit stage to perform for the public. But it's just a marvelous opportunity for them to see the real pros in action and to look forward to their future as professional artists.
And from experience, Kurt Elling, Christian McBride, two of my favorite performances of all time that have been part of past Butler Arts Fest, and these world-renowned artists seem so genuine about mentoring the kids.
That's absolutely. And I think part of the mission of the faculty members is to bring artists to Arts Fest that are about mentoring students and helping our students grow as professionals, as individuals, as members of our community, and as, you know, artists that will be performing on stage, hopefully the same stage as these professional artists are now.
They might, the current students and graduate students might be invited back to be those world-class artists at a Butler Arts Fest.
Exactly.
Of the future. I want to talk about, there's so much, but one thing I love about Butler Arts Fest is it's a chance to just kind of go and immerse yourself, and you go to dozens of different performances. We won't be able to talk about them all, but I'm especially intrigued by Too Many Sopranos. Tell me about that.
Yes. Well, that's the Butler Opera Theater production, and that's actually happening on Friday, April 14th and Saturday, April 15th. That piece was composed by an IU Jacobs School of Music faculty member, Edwin Pinhorwood, and it has been performed at IU Bloomington, but I don't know if it's been performed here in Indianapolis, so this might be the Indianapolis debut of that piece. And the students are excited. You know, this is what happens when you've got a lot of lovely ladies who have soprano voices, is that you find a piece that suits all of them, and that's exactly what this is. It really is a showcase for some of our wonderful female singers in the School of Music.
And there's some humor, because the plot is here's a summary. Four divas arrive in heaven only to learn that there's room for just one of them in the heavenly chorus because all the tenors and basses are in hell.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think there might be a little bit of cattiness in there even.
I think it plays off the idea of the diva, perhaps, and really taps into that spirit in a tongue-in-cheek way. Yeah, absolutely. It's one of those operas that you can really giggle at while you're watching, which are sometimes rare.
Yeah, indeed. You have a survey of four centuries of chamber music coming up at Eidson Duckwall, which has spectacular acoustics.
Well, thank you. That's on Tuesday, April 18th, and that really is a showcase for our faculty members. That's a chamber music performance by some of the most renowned musicians in Indianapolis who are also on faculty in the Jordan College of the Arts. It's also a showcase for two of our resident composers, Michael Shelley and Frank Felice. So their works will be performed, and will also be performing works that span 400 years. So it'll be a taste of a little bit of everything for people who want to come and enjoy it. I think that it's a wonderful opportunity to get a sampling of all of the talent that we have on faculty in the Jordan College of the Arts. So you can see a little bit of everything from a little bit of everybody.
Mm, love it. Maria Schneider is coming, and boy, she's played with everybody. Jazz at Lincoln Center, St. Paul Chamber Orchestra. She collaborated with David Bowie. What a talent.
She is. She's actually one of the rare musicians or composers that has won a Grammy Award in both classical music and jazz. And one thing about Maria Schneider is that you can't really pin down her style of music. It bridges both of those and beyond. This is one of those wonderful opportunities for our students to see a composer in action and really kind of tap into her mind. She will be performing, well, she won't be performing. She'll be with the students who are performing. And then Rob Dixon, an Indianapolis jazz great, will be performing with the students as well. So it's a really exciting evening of jazz music, but it also will blur a little bit of the lines of jazz music into that classical realm.
So forget about having everything fit into neat categories, neat little boxes.
We like to get away from those categories where we are at Butler. We like to think more broadly sometimes.
Public radio listeners have probably heard the name Alan Lightman. Tell us about Alan Lightman and his appearance.
Alan Lightman will be appearing on Thursday, April 20th, and he is a novelist, a physicist, and just a brilliant mind. He wrote the international bestseller Einstein's Dreams, and really bridges the worlds between science and the humanities. And he's a professor at MIT who serves in both of those areas. So he's just a brilliant mind. We're partnering with the Indiana Humanities on this. They're bringing him to town and presenting him as part of Arts Fest. And Rabbi Sasso, will be interviewing him. So we'll be dipping into his mind a little bit and talking about his experiences bridging the worlds between science and the humanities.
That seems like a, kind of a great event to have towards the end of this this year, where not faculty-wide, campus-wide, you've been talking about the role of the brain.
Absolutely, and this is actually the novel Einstein's Dreams is really dipping into Einstein's brain and kind of revealing what maybe would have been happening in his mind. And so dipping into Alan Lightman's mind as well is really fascinating, and kind of understanding how all of these things come together to create creativity. And that's really the core of Arts Fest as well.
Mm-hmm. And if somebody's out there saying, wait, what about dance?
Mm-hmm. Well, we have the Spring Ballet this year, and it's Giselle, and it is one of the most romantic ballets written, and it was actually first composed in 1841, so it's a very early ballet, and it is ethereal. It is the story of a woman who was jilted by her lover and then comes back from the grave and actually saves him, nonetheless. Our students in the ballet department are some of the best in the country, if not the world. And this is a real showcase for their talents. The Butler Ballet Orchestra will also be performing, so it's a showcase of students from the School of Music. But it is the highest level of performance. It is almost as fabulous as any professional ballet, if not as good.
Butler University's Meg Lefick. The university's fifth annual Arts Fest continues through April 24th all around campus. You can plan your arts binge at butlerartscenter.org. Every week, a Cultural Manifesto's Kyle Long talks five songs with someone from our community. Here's this week's journey.
I'm Kyle Long from Cultural Manifesto. I'm here today with one of my favorite photographers in Indianapolis, Ted Somerville. Ted, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And Ted, you're one of my favorite photographers because of the work you've done to capture the Indianapolis music scene. You know, you've captured it in a way I don't think anyone else has, the scene that's happening today. You're at the hip-hop festivals. You were at Cataracts and covering all the music in Fountain Square. But you also go out to the West Side and photograph a lot of the music happening in the Latin American music scene. Things that a lot of the other media outlets here in town don't pay attention to. Tell us a little bit about your work here as a photographer.
I started with Nuvo in 2008, and that was a great way to just expand and see and explore the city. So really just being out in the scene, you know, music scene, I would just learn about other stuff from there.
What are the kinds of music you really like to photograph?
Oh, man. I like something energetic, you know. People are really performing. It makes photographing it easier. But really the most exciting thing for me is that West Side scene where people are getting down to, you know, the most authentic kind of Mexican music that you could find in Indianapolis.
Yeah, and you've done a great job of that. And people can look at your photos at tedsomerville.com. And Ted, you spent, a couple years in Brazil recently, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to share some Brazilian music with us today, right?
Yep.
What is your first song for us?
So I've got one called Rios, Pontes e Overdrives by Chico Science.
Ah.
And it's a song about Recife. So he was from the city of Recife, which means reef. And he's basically just repping his city. It's special to me because I met my best friend in Rio, my best Brazilian friend in Rio, talking about Chico Science while I was taking pictures of him skateboarding. And then we just started talking about Chico Science and made friends over that song. And then I went to Recife and met my wife, Raquel, there. So.
Second song for us, Ted.
Second song, Preciso Me Encontrar, means I need to find myself. It's by Cartola, who was one of the most important figures in samba history. He's talking about, it's kind of introspective, he's talking about needing to go for a walk and find himself and, I don't know, maybe get centered.
Deixe-me ir, preciso andar, vou por aí a procurar, sorrir pra não chorar.
Well, thanks for playing. This is one of my favorite songs ever, so
yeah,
thank you.
Sure.
And your third song, Ted.
Maracatu Atomico. Most people know it for the Chico Science version, but this one is the Gilberto Gil. This is this great 80s pop, samba, funk, groove. I just love it. You know, it's really groovy and fun. Four is Deixa Eu Dizer, it means let me say, by Claudia. So she was a great singer. She wasn't really big, but she had this hit, and it's been used for hip-hop samples. And I don't know, I love the sound. It's a big band sound, you know, it's got a lot of punch, and she's just belting about needing to like vent.
Fifth and final song, too.
Last one is this track by this guy who, I don't know why he's not really well known because his music is awesome, but his name is Escurinho, and it's like a, I don't know if it's forró, but it's the traditional beat mixed with punk. So you got this northeastern Brazilian style of drumming with this really awesome heavy punk sound.
And TedSomerville.com, that's your website. What are folks going to see if they log on to TedSomerville.com?
It's kind of evolving. I'm just trying to, you know, still find my niche. But for now, I do have a gallery of my project of Brazil, just a lot of shots that I took in Brazil, and then portraits, and yeah.
And they'll see your photos capturing the Indianapolis music scene like no one else ever has, right?
Yeah, right.
Thank you so much, Ted. I appreciate these amazing songs. I love it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Here, Kyle's A Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Wednesday nights at 9 or Saturday nights at 10. Thanks for listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and today's contributors included Pete Brown and Eric Hartvig. Hear The Art of the Matter Saturday mornings at 7, or join us Thursday nights at 9 after Indivisible. And remember, you can always listen to and share our podcast at WFYI.org. Next week, we'll hear from Jim Naramore about his debut novel, Chock Full of Magic, Spirits, and Mystery, and we'll see the Rhythm Discovery Center through kids' eyes. And of course, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do?
All of that and so much more on The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in central Indiana and Indianapolis. The Art of the Matter is executive producer Roxana Caldwell, producer Melissa Davis, contributor Jill Dittmeyer, and host Sharon Gamble. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.